So I realised I'd gone for the Buddhist Centre in London, Bethnal Green, first time a week, exactly a week before my birthday. I remember that because the second week I didn't go because I was actually going to the theatre, some friends of mine. And why am I saying that? Well, I think that was quite a precarious moment, actually. I think I could have easily not come back after that first time because there was this gap. And I don't know what to say about it, except that I did go back. I'm really glad I did. So, yeah, I was over in South Bristol on Friday, and I said, if any of you want to come to a talk to celebrate my 20th birthday. And Eloise nearly choked. She came up to me after and said, I just don't think you can get away with that. I neglected to say that it was the 20th birthday of my ordination. Anyway. So, yeah, I was ordained in September 1987, joined the Western Buddhist Order. And I know my public, there's two ordinations, I might get back to that, but there's a private and there's a public. And I know my private ordination was September the 1st, 1987. I'm ashamed to say, not much, but I am sort of ashamed to say that I can't remember when the public ordination was, but you know, Danis and I were talking about, it may even have been tonight, it was certainly somewhere within these days. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to, this is kind of like, we used to do this a lot in the FW, I don't know if people used to do life stories where, say on retreats, you'd sit together and people would just tell you their life story, which is actually a very nice, interesting, but quite a healing in some ways and revelatory thing to do. This is a sort of Buddhist life story. And the way I got into it in the end was I'm going to read you some poems. At the beginning of each significant stage, I'll read you a poem. I think they're all by me, actually, and they're all quite short, you'll be pleased with. Anyway, the first stage, preface, by a poem called Writing Poetry at Edinburgh Airport. Lee Poe said, to read poems is to be alive twice. At the airport, it's easier to see how everyone is equal. There's only one human story. It ends in leaving. Just in case, Li Po was a Ming Dynasty Chinese poet. And he wrote to a friend of his, Tu Fu, said, thank you for sending me your poems. Reading them is like being alive twice, which I thought was a beautiful image. And it stuck in my mind anyway. So Li Po said, to read poems is to be alive twice. At the airport, it's easier to see how everybody is equal. Everyone is equal. There's only one human story. It ends in leaving. Okay, so why did I start that? What is this leaving that the story ends in? Well, it's death. It's dying. And I'm sitting here tonight because I didn't die in February 1981. In February 1981, I was living in San Francisco, California. I was a musician, composer, songwriter. And I had a car accident. I was very lucky to survive them. And I'd made a note here that one of my favorite poems is by Dylan Thomas. I set it to music, actually. And the first line is, I see the boys of summer in their ruin. I see the boys of summer in their ruin. I love that. I love that image. I love the music of that. And it struck me that in a way that's what happened to me in California. If you've never been, California is a very summery place, even in December. There's only two seasons in California. There's 11 months of sunshine and December it rains. And that's it. So it's very summery, lively, full of beauty kind of place. The sea, the sun, the sand. So it's a kind of strange place to nearly die in a way, because it feels like it's the place where everyone's going to live. And to be in the midst of that, and to see, as it were, the boys, the girls of summer in their ruin, was quite a shock to me. It pulled me up in a very big way, that life is very precarious, fragile, and also very precious. The Tibetans say this precious human life. I suppose at that point in my life, I had suddenly had a glimpse of just how precious life can be, should be. And that threw me into a kind of, I guess you'd have to say, a spiritual crisis. I, in many ways, a very charmed life, but I wasn't very happy, and I think that's probably true. At some deep level, I was deeply unhappy. I have a melancholic nature anyway, but there was something not happening in my life that I needed. So a few months later, I found myself back in London, and I went to London Buddhist Centre. As I say, I went on June the 19th, 1981, and the first practice I was given by Ben Arati was the Metta Bhavana, which is why I suggested we do that tonight. And that was a revelation to me, the Metta Bhavana. Anyway, so the second time preface this is called Fellow Traveller. Actually, I wrote this for Ananda, who is birthday of Buddha, fellow traveler. The teacher is given. It's the disciple we have to find. The teacher is given. It's the disciple we have to find. I think it's a Sufi idea. It's an idea I've known for a long time, that teacher reveals themselves when the pupil is ready. Is that a Sufi? It sounds good, yeah. I could have been Groucho Marx. I think it's a Sufi idea, and I've always been fascinated by this idea that the teacher reveals himself when the pupil is ready. I have to say, in my life, this has proved to be very true. I've had a lot of teachers because of the nature of my career. I studied to become a composer, so I worked with other composers, and it was quite, fascinating, astounding, you know, that the right teachers seemed to turn up at the right time. And this process continued for me into the spiritual life, because just at the point when I really needed a spiritual teacher, I was given one. Okay, so I went to the London Buddhist Centre. Some of you may know it's down in Bethnal Green, an old fire station. It was in its sort of opening prime when I got there. It just opened a couple of years ago, and it was really a buzzing place. I made a few notes of, well, what did I find at the London Buddhist Centre? The first thing I found was an oasis of beauty, which I'm glad to say I think this centre in Bristol is becoming. I have to say the carpet change was a big step there. This place is an oasis of beauty, tranquility, I think. And I think it certainly should be. And certainly when I went through the doors of the London Buddhist Centre, that's what I experienced. More than anything, actually, that's what hit me. Bethnal Green, back in the early 80s, was not a nice place to be. It got a bit better. Pretty grim. Life was tough there for people. And to step through that into this wonderful Buddhist Centre was a very, very beautiful thing. And partly I kept going back because of the sheer beauty of the place. It was like just somewhere to go where one could be in peace. That was important. Second thing I wrote was friendship. And that's the main thing, really. I mean, this man, Damarati, who taught me the Metta Bhavana, some of his name, he became my spiritual brother, Kalyana Mitra, 10 years later. And he's been my friend ever since. The first night I met Damarati, he became my friend, and we've been friends ever since. We don't see much of each other, so he's traveling a lot now. But he's someone in my life I absolutely know that if I need help, he's there. I said to him, I said, if I ever find myself in a hole, Damarati, I'll call you. And he said, just call me before you get into the hole. that's a real friend, I think. So Damarati, signifies friendship for me. And there are so many people in my life now that I can trace back to that, particularly a man called Tal Bajwa, who came to the Buddhist Centre exactly the same night as me. We're now very, very, very dear friends, and there's so many people like that. So friendship was a wonderful gift, and Sangharak Shitta, the founder of the Friends of Western Buddhist Order, has always emphasized friendship. There's a famous saying that Ananda, the historical Ananda, Buddha's great disciple, said to him, our masters, friendship is half the spiritual life. And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, or say not so, Ananda. It's the whole of the spiritual life. And it's certainly been the whole of my spiritual life. I have no hesitation saying friendship. So again, I hope that that's what this place becomes for us here, is a place of passion. Okay, I put meditation, self-empowerment. After my car accident, a friend of mine who was a concert pianist in America, she was a very devoted, devout Catholic, and she spent quite a lot of time trying to convert me into Catholicism, which I didn't mind that. But the trouble is, I didn't believe in God. So that was a big problem if you're a big Catholic. We never got around that one. We got around Bach and Mozart and Stockhausen, but we never got around. Anyway, dear O'Donnell, bless her. She wrote to me and she said, Bailey, because I was there with him, she said, I really think you need help, which is, you know, not something you particularly want to read in a friend's letter, but I knew she was right. She said, I think you should either get psychotherapy or learn to meditate. And actually, it was that letter that triggered me going to the London Buddhist Center. So I was really angry with her. I thought, what right has this woman got to tell me what to do in my life? Actually, she had every right, because she really cared about me. And the idea that I should learn to meditate was a very wise one. At the time, psychotherapy didn't appeal to me at all. I just wasn't interested. It scared me, I think. Meditation felt more like, well, it was within my own bounds. So another great gift I got at the Buddha Center was the power of meditation, which has not gone away. I haven't been a great meditator in my life. I went many years not meditating, actually. And about 6 years ago on a family holiday, it got so unbearable. I just thought, I've got to meditate, and I've done it every day ever since. So. Families have their very. I just couldn't believe how wound up I was getting. Anyway, so meditation is a great gift, and I do encourage you to keep at it. But, meditation. Self-empowerment. You see, and that's the key to the next thing. No God. The thing I discovered at the London Buddha Center was there wasn't any God lurking around. I kept waiting for him or her to jump out of a corner and say, thou shalt not, sinner. But there wasn't a God at the London Buddha Center. It was Sangharakshita, but there wasn't any God. And thank God there was no God. A serious point, actually, because I really had given up on religion. And I don't think I wanted to give up on religion. I think I was born, gosh, can you say such a thing? Well, I was going to say I was born a mystic, and I think I do have a very strong mystical streak in me. Life is a very mysterious thing to me, and I find that mystery very beautiful, actually. And I really wanted to become a Christian. I tried twice in my adult life to try sincerely to become a Christian. And I was walking down a church to give up my... I can't remember how you did it, but, you know, to give yourself up to Jesus and God. And I was walking down this church, and all my friends were really, yeah. And I got halfway down, and I turned around, and I walked out. I just couldn't do it. I knew that, for me, the notion of God didn't work. So to discover in Buddhism that there was a spiritual, religious, mystical even path that wasn't dependent on God was an incredible gift to me. I can't tell you. What a gift that's been. And I have no, you know, if people can find God and it works, then fantastic. I have no problem with this. Certainly no more. But for me, it didn't work. And it never was going to work. I don't understand where we come from, why we're here. But I don't particularly want to label that God. If some people do, that's fine. Okay? The other thing I got was very, very unexpected. Within 6 months of going to the London Buddhist Center, I found myself working on building sites in London. And I really wasn't expecting to do that. I was a musician. My fingers, I played the piano. I did used to wear gloves, when most people wouldn't have. You know, like reading the paper. But I did find myself in a building, of all things, a Buddhist building co-op. We used to have these things back then, called Friends Building Services, or FBS. And, wow, what a gift. I worked with a man called Attila, who, wow, I mean, again, someone who's been a very important figure in my life. And He absolutely is uncanny. He is now psychotherapist, and he'd come up and say, what are you thinking about? You're thinking about something, isn't it? What is it? And he's just sort of pointing at you. I'm just thinking about punishing you. That's the bloody trouble. You don't think about the right things. You know? It's about your mother, isn't it? I have a phrase that's like. So I find myself in a Buddhist building co-op of all things. My dad saying, thank God. He said, thank God. You know, he said, at last, you're such a prima donna. He called me, my father called me a prima donna. Right, as he my parents are cockneys. They don't beat around the bush. He said, time you got your hands dirty. And he was absolutely right, actually. He was absolutely right. Why am I going on about this? But the reason is that, actually, it embodies a very, very important Buddhist principle. To me, the most important Buddhist teaching, which is the middle way. If you don't know this, I'll tell you briefly. They say if the bamboo bends too far to the left, bend it too far to the right, you end up with a straight bamboo. I bent too far to the left, actually, in all sorts of ways. And it was time to sort of make a readjustment. I was just too precious. You know, I'm a composer. I've got something important to do. That is true, actually. But you don't do that at the expense of life. And I was, to be honest. One of my last music teachers, a great Australian composer called David Lumsdaine, said to me, very important thing, he said, you're writing music to protect yourself from life. Really, you want to write music to celebrate life. Actually, I would say that's when I started on the spiritual path, I think. I was really taken aback by that. And I have to say, I'll slip it in here because I might get later, you can use Buddhism to do that. Because I've done it and I see it around me. Do not use Buddhism to protect yourself from life. It's not what the Buddha asked of us. Use it to celebrate life. That's a good teaching. Anyway, the middle way, I'd gone too far one way. Working in a building team, getting my hands dirty, was really good for me. And it's very interesting because a dear friend of mine in the States, she said to me, most people when they get spiritual, they get all mystical. And you end up mixing cement. So this makes me really interested in Buddhism. And she has become very interested in Buddhism. Precisely because that, she said, you know, you can get all sort of up there. Actually, for me, Buddhism's been about coming down to earth. I started off up there, I've come over. Yep. The third stage is actually ordination. You can see I'm just signposting a few thoughts, really. I'm pleased that I thought about this. This came to me yesterday. I'm going to read you a poem called A Poem Beginning with a Line by William Stafford. You may know that some of you will know. William Stafford was a great American poet who I was very lucky to get to know, and I ended up becoming his publisher. I'm not sure what the connection between this poem and ordination is, but I'll just let it sit there. Poem Beginning with a Line by William Stafford. I let my conscious life yield a little. I let go of delight and grief. Not all I need is described by name or number. Take this feather, so soft, yet in the right ring it flies. I let my conscious life yield a little. I let go of delight and grief. Not all I need is described by name or number. Take this feather, so soft, yet in the right wing it flies. So I got ordained in Spain at a place called Cucuyloca. It's a men's ordination retreat centre. And I was the first, we were the first group to go there. It just opened and it was hell. It rained all the time. We got washed off the mountains, but it was fantastic. I was there for 13 weeks. And it probably, in some ways, was the most profound 13 weeks of my life, actually. I can't say it was the most enjoyable. To be honest, a lot of times I was a bit bored. I was kind of waiting to come back. But looking back, it was a very precious time. And I do say to people, if they're going off to get ordained, make the most of it, because it's like 13 weeks. Now I think it's a bit longer, isn't it? 16. It's time out. And it's very hard to get time out from your own life. It generally doesn't happen. For 13 weeks, I had nothing to do but meditate, study Buddhism. Be with friends, reflect. I actually wrote a lot of poems. So that was my ordination. And I just wrote down a few thoughts about joining the order. The first one I wrote was new name. Weird, but good reminder of aspiration. Okay. I have to say, it does strike me as weird that I've joined the Western Buddhist Order and I've got a name called Manjushra. I don't understand that. You know, why aren't I George? But it's just the way it goes. I know Sangharakshita Shittu in the past did experiment with giving people Western names. He gave a few people names from Blake, William Blake. Interesting enough, there was, I think, two at least. And they both resigned. So maybe he knows something. Maybe there is some wisdom here. So I do find the idea of being Manjushra both delightful, but also slightly weird. And I'm glad to say I've never been that attached to it. I work as a fundraiser, and I write as a poet. And I don't use my Buddhist name, and it doesn't particularly bother me. I don't feel the need to do that. But I really love my name. I particularly love it because it was given to me by Sangalakshita. And he said to me when he came, he said, I've had a lot of trouble with your name. But what he wanted to do was get music into my name because of my background. So Manju means gentle, and Svara means music, so it means gentle music, which is a lovely name. So I'm very happy to have that. And having a new name, whatever it is actually, which I never would have realized how it happened to me, it's a wonderful aid memoir. When I lose the plot, which I do, I sometimes just say Manjushra, and even just saying my name is enough to kind of pull me back a little bit. I was on holiday with my mother a couple of weeks ago. I love my mother, but she can really wind me up. And just occasionally, instead of being David, I said Manjushra, and it was enough to stop that track that we get. Yeah. So having a new name is a very precious gift, actually. I do rejoice in that. And I love my name. I just still feel it's a bit weird that we're Western Buddhists and we have Indian names. But maybe it's the middle way again. I was David, so Manjushra, get something in between. So I suppose I'm smiling by saying this. I just realized, if you ever decide to get ordained and you find your name weird, don't worry about it. It's okay. It's okay. Second thing, joining the order. I wrote Fellow Travellers. And I remember one of my favourite phrases in poetry is by W.B. Yeats. And he says, the pilgrim soul in you, the pilgrim soul in you. I just love that image of the pilgrim soul. I think I have a pilgrim soul. I think everyone has a pilgrim soul, actually. I think everyone is seeking something. And what I really rejoice in the Western Buddhist Order is that I can talk about serious things with serious people and not get ridiculed. When I talk about, you know, I think, I'm not sure if there is a God, but I do believe in mystery. People don't just think, oh God, he's gone off again. You know, they don't just walk out of the room. They say, well, what do you mean? Or, you know, I had this meditation experience where I suddenly felt I wasn't in my body, and I don't call the doctor. They just thought, oh, let's look at that. It's such a gift. I tell you why, you may well know. So it's lonely not to be able to talk about these things. It's very, very lonely to not be able to talk about the things that are most precious to you, be it poetry, football, or in my case, the religious life. Until I found the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, particularly until I got ordained, I didn't have that forum to talk about the thing that is most important, which is, well, I can't talk about it. It's beauty, is truth, is key, so whatever. But anyway, the spiritual fellowship with one another, which we enjoy, is such a precious thing. And again, I hope there's something that we find here. Okay. The third thing I wrote was ethics. I'll read you the 10 precepts. You might not know these, some of you. When you get ordained, you don't do the 5 precepts, you do 10 precepts. And I'll read them for you. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body. With stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. With truthful communication, I purify my speech. With words kindly and gracious, I purify my speech. with utterance helpful and harmonious, I purify my speech, abandoning covetousness for tranquility. I purify my mind, changing hatred into compassion. I purify my mind, transforming ignorance into wisdom. I purify my mind. So when you join the order, you take on these 10 precepts. When I typed those out yesterday, I actually felt my mental state change. I was actually surprised by the fact that to actually just sit down and write them out took a degree more thought than I would if I just say them. And as I wrote them, I realized how beautiful each one of them was. What an incredible thing, you know, just take one at random. With words kindly and gracious, I purify my speech. I mean, how much better is the world when our speech is kindly and gracious? How easy is it not to be kind and gracious? Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. So, you know, if I didn't have anything except those 10 precepts, that would be more than enough for me. I really feel that was such a great gift to be given those. And before that, the 5 precepts, which in essence, these are body, speech, mind. Again, it was a revelation to me to discover in Buddhism that precepts weren't things you hit yourself over the head with and others. It's not a thou shalt not. It's not your sinning, miserable wretch, and every time you break, it's not like that. It's like, give it a go, do your best, and if you get it wrong, wake up and I'll go tomorrow. You know, it's work in progress. And the ethics of Buddhism are such a great gift for me. I was reminded of something William Stafford says. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. Well, yeah, the darkness around us is deep, actually. There's a lot of darkness around us, and it is deep. And as Stafford said, it's important that awake people be awake. And I think the precepts are one of the kind of guardians of our awakeness to the degree that we are awake. As you may know, in Buddhism, the name Buddha means one who's awakened. And again, I love that idea that at the core of the Buddhist teaching is the idea of waking up. Well, you can do that anytime, right? Just open your eyes, be awake. And it's important that awake people be awake because the darkness around us is deep. And I see the 10 precepts as a sort of guardian of that darkness, of that light actually within the dark. So that's very precious to me. And again, I hope when we come to Buddhist centers, we get a taste of this. And I think it should be tasted not through words and sermons, but through practice, through experience, through observation. Hopefully people that are meditating, following the Buddhist path, will manifest these qualities to some degree. A fourth thing was what I called mentors and mentoring. And allow me to say this, but on Friday I was with someone who's just joined the order. And he said a really lovely thing to me. He said, Manjusha, being with you, I feel he's helping me take my place in the order. Because you're an elder. I was very moved, actually. And he said, have you really listened to what I said? He said, have you taken on that I'm rejoicing in your merits? And I realized I hadn't. So he said it again. And I said, well, I'm going to be giving a talk on Monday about being in the order for 20 years. So it was very beautiful. But then it triggered the thought that what was so beautiful for me about that in particular was that I've been in that place and I joined the order and I still have people that I look up to that are my kind, like Kamarashi, like local nature in India. They're people that are my guardians, if you like, of my better self. You know, we have this idea in the Western Buddhist order of Kalyana Mitras, beautiful friends, that's literally translation. And even before you join the order, in my case many years later, you ask two people to become your beautiful friend, your Kalyana Mitra. And I think it just came to me, but I think one way to describe that process, they're like guardians of your better self. Friends are the people that protect you from your worst self sometimes. We need that. We can't always do that to ourselves. So I think mentors and mentoring is such a wonderful gift, actually. I have to say, in a world that I think has become very suspicious of the notion of the elder, the teacher, the wise elder, we're very quick, increasingly, to bring people down, you know, to the same base level. Well, there's nothing wrong with pricking a bit of pomposity, but you can also do a lot of damage. You know, some people deserve praise. There's nothing wrong with praise. It's a beautiful quality. To rejoice in merits is a very, very significant thing. And I think the order is built on this kind of two-way process of rejoicing in those who've gone before you and then letting those who follow you to rejoice in you. I think that's a very beautifully human thing, it seems. And again, I hope that through our contact here, we get a taste of it. And each of us can take our place in what is called the spiritual hierarchy, not probably a very fashionable idea of that, but anyway. I think there are hierarchies, and it's better they're spiritual ones than power ones, or wealth ones, or glamour ones. The last thing I think, yeah, the last thing I read, was the fact that when you get ordained, you get given a meditation practice called a sadhana. It's a visualization practice. Many people do this figure here, Padmasambhava. In fact, when I was getting ordained, I thought I was going to choose Padmasambhava. But his missus popped out from behind the rock, green colour, and she took me. So you get a visualization practice. It's a mysterious thing. I still can't claim to understand it. I do it in a very unorthodox way. The word imagination totally fits. But my view is I've got to make it up as I go along. You know, these figures came out of people's meditation experience, and I had meditation experiences, so I recreate figures. Anyway, the value for me of choosing a feminine figure, Green Tara, who's a beautiful female form, is it's transformed romanticism. It's work in progress. But I have a very strong romantic streak, and I really love women. So I put them together and I get Green Tara, and it sort of takes me slightly out of that merry-go-round. It's love of beauty, but in a pure way. Refining those energies, which are very, I have no problem with them, I think they're very beautiful in their own way, but you can get lost in that world of sex, romance, all that. And just to have a sense that it can lead you to something even more beautiful and profound, for me, is very important, sort of transformative. But I'm a bit of a Sufi in a way, because I think you have to go down and go up at the same time, or tantric. So the sadhana, be it Padmasambhava, who's a magician, Tara, who for me is a muse, Milarepa, who's another magician. There's a wonderful book by the Sancho called Meeting the Buddhas, isn't it? Yeah. It goes into this. I recommend that. So they're gifts that you get from joining the Western Buddhists. There's one other gift which I've slightly separated because it cuts across all of this for me. There's another weep. I am driving in India. So many people seen. So many lives untouched. So many people seen. So many lives untouched. Bagdogra to Siliguri, Saturday, 3rd of December, 2005. I was on my way up to Kalimpong in the Himalayas. I'd flown into Bagdogra, Siliguri. And I was just in this jeep to visit a project. And this thought just came to me. So many people seeing. I've been in some of the most remote parts of India. And you just think you're on your own and someone will pop up behind the tree. It's just, wherever you go in India, there's a billion people there. So it's not surprising. You'll find someone eventually, or they'll find you. So many people seeing, so many lives untouched. Why did I write this here? I'll put this here. Well, because the overarching thread in all of this for me is the work of the Karanar Trust, the charity that the members of the Western Buddhist Order set up in 1980. That specifically, to begin with anyway, works with the ex-untouchable people, now known as Dalits. The people that for thousands of years were outcast in the Hindu system. They were Hindus, but they weren't allowed to practice Hinduism. They were Hindus, but they weren't allowed to hear or read the scriptures. They were Hindus, but they weren't allowed to go to the temples. It's actually said, and I think it's true, that if they were to hear the religious scriptures, then their ears, they filled their ears with molten lead, which I can't Like, I think that shows a lack of imagination.
Yes.
If religion does that to you, then I don't understand that. We work with these people. Many of them converted to Buddhism in the 50s to get out of the cult system. So that's the connection. In 1985, in a strange set of circumstances, which I can't go into that, I found myself fundraising for Karma. And if joining the building team was one of these kind of miraculous balancing acts, then definitely fundraising for me was another one. And I actually went out, knocked people's doors and said, give us some money. And amazingly, I was really good at it. And it's been a crucial part of my life ever since, fundraising. Now I train fundraisers because I'm coaching. I'm deaf. And if people say, go away, I think they say, nice day, and I'll just carry on standing there. I don't inflict on the people public, but I still work with Hannah, I still train. There's a team out in Bristol at this moment, six women, and I'm working with them at the present. Anyway, fundraising, Karnar. We've had Danish bless them, has done a couple of really lovely evenings at Karnar. But I have to say, it is the most important thing in my life, actually. I think I can say that. It's the last thing I'll give up. Dado Rinpoche was one of Sangha Exeter's main teachers. And he set up a school in Kalimpong, which was where I was going when I wrote this little poem, for Tibetan refugee children. Dado Rinpoche said, if you don't know what to do next in your life, do something for other people. If you don't know what to do next in your life, do something for other people. And I really hold on to that. I mean, say, I've had a very blessed life in some ways. Not an easy life, but a very blessed life. And I just got to a point in 85 when I thought, I've got to start paying back the debts here. This is not good. I'm taking more than I'm giving back, I think. That was my sense. So I decided to do some fundraising, and I can say I've been doing it ever since. And it'll be the last thing I'll give up, because I still think there's a debt to pay. To be clothed, fed, sheltered, not attacked for your beliefs, not told what you can and cannot do as an artist. These are such great gifts. So many people in this world don't have these freedoms. People I know and revere in India certainly don't, because of their background. It's very important to me that I try and make amends as best I can. So I put it here because without the FWPO and the order, I wouldn't be doing what I do in this way. And it's very, very precious to me. It's my chance to do something for other people. And a lot of the time, I'm on my own, I'm writing. I think I have a generous nature, and it was fundraising that really allowed me to rejoice in that. Five. Guide to the path. Small girls skipping down the road ahead of a mother, making a dance with just the right amount of perfection. Small girls skipping down the road ahead of a mother, making a dance with just the right amount of perfection. One of the great gifts of poetry is you stumble upon ideas you would never have if you didn't try and write a poem. The idea of just the right amount of perfection, I love that. I wrote it as well, but I really love that. I think, well, that's pretty smart, actually. The right amount of perfection is a pretty smart idea, and I wouldn't have got it if I hadn't written that poem, which is a gift from the muse, as far as I'm concerned. Little kids dancing down the street have just the right amount of perfection to do the dance and not worry what they look like. As we get older, we lose that right amount of perfection. So this is the bit you touched on, possibly, but the more controversial. If you don't want to hear this, you can leave now. If you think that the FWBO is perfect, I suggest you leave the room. Because you know what? It ain't. And you know why? Because I'm not perfect. He's not perfect, she's not perfect. And very few of us are perfect. Some of you might be, I hope so. But I certainly not. And most of the people I know in the Western Buddhist order, including its founder, are not perfect. And that can be quite a struggle. And I think for some it remains a struggle to come to terms with that. But actually, to me, that's a great gift. This shows how people can work together happily, beautifully, with imperfection. What a great thing. I mean, who needs perfection? Perfection's useless in the human life because we don't touch perfection here. So, in a sense, the imperfection of the Western Buddhist order is a great gift. How does this manifest, this imperfection? Well, funny enough, it's the desire for perfection. There's been a lot of this in the FWBO. I think we're getting better at it. But we get the teachings, and suddenly, whoosh, like that, you know, we're on a runner. We leave all this mucky stuff behind. We become holier than thou, purer than pure. We're Buddhas. And it's all nonsense, you know. I don't think the Buddha was doing that. The Buddha lived in squalor. If you've ever walked around India, you're going to hit squalor pretty quickly. He lived and breathed it. So don't do the, you know, rising above it all trick, because in the end you come back down, I can assure you. Another thought I had about this is, you know, when you wear one of these things, it makes you special. Get projected on, it's great, but it's disastrous as well. I mean, people think you're wonderful just because you've got a funny name and you wear one of these. I had a very interesting experience. I was at the London Buddhist Centre a few years ago, impromptu, in disguise. I was working for Karen and I the evening. I went to a beginner's so-called class at the London Buddhist Centre. And I didn't have my case up. So I'm just standing there and I get talking to this guy. Well, a really nice conversation. He said, do you come here often? So I can legitimately say, no, I don't actually, because I had never saw that. So, you know, I was being a bit miserable. Anyway, and then right at the end, they rang the bell and said, okay, so we're going to the shrine room, we can teach them to pay. So he said, so what's your name? I said, Manjushra. And his face completely changed. It was like, oh my God, he's one of them. It's all right, it's all right. And I'm so glad, actually, that I had that experience, because it was an important lesson to me. It's good just to be a regular guy sometimes. It's great to be different. It's great to be special. But don't get attached to it, because it will trip you up. Certainly has me. So there is a danger in joining something like a religious order. You become special. I'm getting into my stride now. But I was in a bed and breakfast in Dublin a few years ago with my mum. And we were sitting there eating our breakfast. And suddenly the priest turned up. And this priest was like a cop. Forgive me if any of you are Catholics and revered priests. I don't mean to be rude. But this priest was like a cockerel. And there were these three women absolutely doting. Suddenly, my mum's egg and my toast was forgotten because the priest was there, you know, the priest. So he looked at me and he said, so what do you do? I said, well, actually, I'm in the same business as you. I said, I'm a religious minister. And he literally didn't know what to do. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm a Buddhist. And he looked, he just got me. And I thought, poor sod, you've spent all of your adult life being projected onto. What a terror from a religious, spiritual point of view. What a disaster that is. Okay. So, you know, there is this inherent danger. I like praise, but don't get too much. Jung. Carl Jung. Someone told me, Robert Bly, I'm not dropping names there, but Robert Bly told me that Jung wouldn't take students into his institute in Zurich until they'd proven themselves in some other sphere. So if you wanted to study with Jung in psychoanalysis, you had to have been a teacher, a truck driver, a carpenter, but you had to have done something else first. And I think that's a really wise thing. And I think we've suffered in the order at times. I think we're getting better at this. But I think in the past, the main thing people did was they got ordained. Mm. And it's nonsense, because you don't know, as my dad would say, you don't know what side your bread's buttered on. He put it another way, actually. So don't let it go to your head like it went to mine. You know, this is part of something bigger. Let's never forget that. So I think we've had a bit of premature arrogance at times. And as I say, I actually love the order because it's imperfect. But then I am for the final thing. Shakyamuni. I think this one's up on the wall, I think. Shakyamuni. Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed. Shakyamuni, which if you don't know is, you know, another name for the Buddha, our Buddha. Something called to him, repeated over, and he noticed. That's a little haiku, and 17 syllables, and I put a lot into that. I think this idea of being called is very important for me. I'm actually writing a book about it now. And I think one of the saddest things that can happen in life is when you're called and you don't, well, as I say, you don't notice, but I think even worse is when you're called and you don't respond. I'm using this word called, I'm going to keep it quite vague, but, you know, we talk about religious calling. I think things do call us. Music definitely called me as a very small child. I'm sure painting called Picasso. Maybe physics, I don't know, because I was reading that. Physics called Einstein. You know, I'm not saying I'm like them, but you know what I mean. We get called by things. But I think a lot of us spend a lot of our energy and time pushing these things away because, as Rilke says, every angel is dangerous. When the angel puts its finger on you, marks you, things change. Yeah, you have to revise your life. And I think a lot of people, a lot of the time, what did I say? They have dreams of leaving. They don't leave their life, they dream of leaving. And there's a line, a famous line from a poem I can't recall, but it's living lives of slow desperation. Living lives of slow desperation. That's a heartbreaking image for me. I think so many of us live lives of slow desperation. And I have to say, Buddhism was my release from a life of slow desperation. And also, it wasn't a dream of leaving, it was a leaving. I actually left much behind me when I joined the Western Buddhist Order. I went forth, as we say. I went forth from, well, an aspiration to go from the conditioned to the unconditioned, or perhaps a better way for me to put it is, from greed, hatred and delusion to generosity, loving kindness and wisdom. So they're the things I aspire to. And I've been given the key to a door that got me out of the prison of self into something a bit bigger. I just wrote this. I'll read it. Buddhism abandons both the miraculous and literalism, and in their place offers ethical models of right action and moving portraits of nobly lived lives. So Buddhism abandons both the miraculous and literalism. So there isn't a Bible that you have to do this. This is the word. Which I think is a terrible tragedy that's happened to Christianity, that they take the Bible literally, it's a metaphor. And in Buddhism, you're not dependent on miracles. The Buddha, you know, why is this Buddha bloke? Why didn't he just wave his magic wand and we all get enlightened? Well, that wouldn't be the point, actually. So there aren't any miracles in Buddhism except practice. If you just keep practicing, something miraculous does happen. And in their place, it offers us ethical models of right action, which is the precepts I touched on, and moving portraits of nobly lived lives. To me, the Buddha is significant, as it is a portrait of a nobly lived life. This is someone who left the pleasure palace, left the kind of trap that his God set for him, where he's surrounded by everything he wants, any moment, every moment of the day, when he saw the four sights, sickness, old age, death, and then the wanderer. And in that process, he gives us a model, an example, for how we too can live.